From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Federal Reserve made everyone sit up straight after their meeting yesterday, signaling they will be tightening the belt that went way out to the last hole to accommodate the flailing economy, meaning they'd lowered interest rates about as low as they can. Now they could slow down on buying U.S. bonds, purchases they began during the pandemic as a way to support the economy. So what else might they do? MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi joins us. Ali, what are they signaling by announcing a tapering of bond buying?
So there's so many words and analogies we can use for this. And my favorite over time has always been a car, right? The Fed is like a car that doesn't have a steering wheel, doesn't have anything else. It's just got brakes and gas. And when it wants to, when the car, meaning the economy, needs to go faster, it puts gas on, it hits the gas. The way it does that is it reduces interest rates. When you reduce interest rates, people will borrow more and they will spend more. When you want to slow the economy down, you want to hit the brakes, you raise interest rates and you slow it down. So bond buying is just another word for reducing interest rates. The way the Fed reduces interest rates is it buys bonds and in exchange puts cash into the market. People take that money and they spend it. What the Fed is now saying is it's going to stop it's going to slow down on that bond buying. We're going to try and get back to normal. The net result of that is going to be a slight and gradual, one hopes, increase in interest rates, which fundamentally slows things down. Think about it on a very personal level. If interest rates are really low, you might buy a car and take a loan on it. You might refinance on a house. You might buy more of a house than you were going to. Same thing for businesses. So what the Fed is saying right now is you've enjoyed really low interest rates for a while, but that was an emergency. And as the emergency goes away and the economy recovers, we're going to start taking away that crutch.
Okay, so that's exactly what everyone wants to know. My colleague Mark yelled out, ask him, is it going to cost me more to borrow money to get a mortgage for a house? You're saying, and that's what an interest rate is, it's the cost of borrowing money.
Yes.
And you're saying, yeah, it might a little bit.
It might. The important thing here is it is a market. In other words, not everything the Fed does has a direct result on what you'll pay for your mortgage or your car or your student loan or your credit card. But generally, it's trend setting because the government is the biggest buyer of bonds and seller of bonds. So when the Fed starts to say, we're going to increase interest rates, the likelihood is your bank rate, your mortgage rate, things like that are going to go up. Mortgage rates are at some of the lowest points they've been in history. You can get a 30-year fixed mortgage on a sort of a normal house for under 3%. Well, historically, it's been more around 6%. Yeah. I don't think we're going to get to 6% right now if you've got good credit, but we're going to start to go above 3 probably over time. Now, lots of things can change. The economy can slow down. We can get another wave of COVID. But the bottom line is the Fed is sending a signal out there to say next year in 2022, you are going to start to see interest rate increases. We're not going to go out of our way to keep interest rates low.
Well, that's what the Federal Reserve is looking at, right? This notion of prices going up. Explain, if you could, in a couple lines, what that concern is.
Yeah, so the problem is if prices go up faster than wages go up, your buying power as an individual decreases, right? You can buy less. So what the Fed wants to do is keep those two things in lockstep. We have seen wages going up in the last several months, quite unexpectedly. So prices do go up. More people have more jobs, have more money. They spend more money on things. The Fed's job is to try and manage those two things. They want unemployment below a certain percentage, and they want inflation below a certain percentage. So there's a little bit of a fear that with all the government stimulus that's been out there, the economy might get a little bit too hot. It's what I call an old people's fear because people like us remember the days,
the
days when interest rates were really high. It's probably not a real, very big fear, but it's the Fed's job to keep an eye on it. So they're a little concerned. They want inflation around 2% a year. Your wages should go up a little more than that in order to keep pace with inflation.
So what do you think our timetable is here?
Fed is talking about next year. Nine of the Fed, the people on the board, have now suggested there'll be one or more rate increases next year. In June, when they polled them, seven of them had said that that was going to be the case. So I think we're going to see rates gradually go up. You might see something happen before the end of the year, but fundamentally, we're talking about 2022, and they'll hopefully try and do it over the course of the year. So by the end of 2022, you will see interest rates substantially higher than they are now. If you're still looking to buy a house, you got a little bit of time. time.
And briefly, apparently sooner than that, we're going to be seeing the Fed taper off its bond buying. The last time they did this in 2013, there was a brief panic. So is there a way they can do it now to make it less scary for people?
Well, that's why they try and use the word taper and warn and expect and over the next, they're trying to tell the market it's going to happen. The problem is the market likes the sugar rush of the Federal Reserve putting lots of money into the economy. And the minute you hear that's not going to happen, everybody gets panicked about the market. It's kind of the way things are these days. So the Fed has to use all this obtuse language to sort of say at some point when it makes sense before, so that we don't, affect things too much, we're going to start to maybe slow down kind of, sort of. That's what the Fed is saying. They're saying, don't worry, this isn't going to be crazy. It's going to move slowly. Everybody just breathe a little bit and it'll be okay. Hopefully we will not have a panic as a result of it.
Or maybe just me, but other than that, hopefully not widespread. MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
This week, India's health minister said his country would resume exports of COVID vaccines. India is the world's largest vaccine maker, and early this year, it made big promises to share globally, and then a U-turn. India halted exports during a COVID surge to save shots for home. Recall the U.S. government similarly saved its vaccines for domestic use. For more, we're joined by Neha Mussey with our partners at The Washington Post. She joins us from New Delhi.
Thank you.
Neha, help us understand the details of this announcement. How much vaccine does India plan to donate, and where is it going to go?
Right. So India's announcement is expected to give a major boost to the strained global vaccine supplies. However, the details are not clear at the moment. We don't know how many doses will be exported or donated. What the health minister did say is that the domestic needs will be prioritized and the surplus supply will be exported. And he also mentioned that India will look to fulfill its COVAX commitment. So that is likely to get priority besides some of India's neighbors, where India has already sent a lot of supplies.
Why the turnaround now? Is there something positive happening on the production side?
So it's a couple of things. One is India's own COVID graph that has changed completely from earlier this year when the exports had to be halted. India is now registering about 30,000 cases a day. In April, they had touched 400,000 daily cases. Secondly, April, when the exports were halted, India's vaccine program was very limited and it was only available to those above 60 and healthcare workers and frontline workers. So it needed to be ramped up urgently. And of course, this announcement came days before Prime Minister Modi's visit to the U.S., where he's, scheduled to meet President Biden, where the matter could have come up.
Is there enough vaccine to go around in India? I understand that only about 20% or so of eligible adults there have been fully vaccinated.
So India's vaccine program got off to a very slow start and did have supply issues for many months, but it's gathered a lot of momentum in recent days. More than 60% of adults have received one shot. In fact, last week, they administered 25 million shots in a day, according to the ministry. So it has gathered momentum and the government aims to inoculate all adults, which would be more than 900 million people by the end of the year.
Okay, and how about the raw material supply chain? I recall back in the spring when India struggled to scale up production, there was mention it had problem getting certain raw materials from the U.S.
I think the raw material problem was not the basis or the reason for the supply issues. For instance, Aadhar Poonawalla, the Serum Institute head, had said that restrictions have impacted the number of doses of Covovax that the Serum Institute can stockpile. That has not been approved yet. So that's not having an impact on day-to-day supplies. Similarly, Bharat Biotech, that's making Covaxin, which is also a local candidate, they had also said that they were facing some problems, but without exactly specifying which were the raw materials they were expecting from the US. And that ban has now, been lifted for a while.
Are there new vaccines expected to be approved by Indian authorities that are going to be added to the world supply?
Right, yes. So the most promising one is by a company called Biological E. Again, it's a made in India vaccine, and the officials in India had expected it to be approved by October. It's unclear when that will exactly happen, but if that happens, that would definitely ramp up of India's own supply, which can then be exported outside.
Great. And finally, any reaction from from COVAX. Surely this has to be a heartening announcement for COVAX.
Yeah, I think they've been waiting for it since April because they were expecting it to happen each month. And even at that time, the Indian officials had said that this was a temporary matter that would get resolved within weeks. They have had to, COVAX has had to, you know, reorient their supply promises. The recent supply numbers are 25% lower than June. So it's definitely a breather for them.
That is Neha Masi, the India-based correspondent for The Washington Post. Neha, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
Global markets are watching the Chinese real estate behemoth Evergrande closely for signs of financial default. Evergrande is at the center of China's massive property development economy, and today it was supposed to pay $84 million in interest to international investors. Another payment is due next week, and a default could rattle confidence in the Chinese economy and beyond. For more, let's bring in Tom Orlick, chief economist for Bloomberg Economics. Tom, hi again.
Hey, Scott. Great to be here.
Great to have you, Tom. Tell us briefly about Evergrande and its debt problem.
So Evergrande is emblematic of a Chinese property sector which is overbuilt and overleveraged. Now, in the past, everyone recognized this as a problem, but it never seemed like the end was nigh. The government was always there to backstop the borrowing of the big developers and to shift policy to head off a slump in the broader property sector. The risk right now is that that backstop, that government guarantee, is looking a lot less solid. Maybe the Chinese government will let Evergrande go. Maybe that will send ripples around China and around the world.
Yeah, boy, it sure sounds like maybe not too big to fail. Now, this first debt payment is due today. It's midday now in the East Coast. What do we know about what happened today and any signals that Beijing could allow Evergrande to miss its payments?
We can't rule out the possibility that China's government will blink at the last minute and step in with support to prevent a default and debt restructuring. At this point, though, that seems fairly unlikely to happen. Evergrande has already missed interest payments on loans to some Chinese banks. We're now at the crunch point in terms of making interest payments on their bonds. There's a one-month grace period, but if we don't see some payments today or in the days ahead, it certainly looks like we're moving into default territory.
And tell me more about signals we're getting from Beijing here. The Wall Street Journal is reporting Chinese local authorities should be getting ready for a possible storm.
So there's a saying in China, Scott, Xia ji rang hou zi kan, kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. And I think the hope from Beijing is that by allowing the Evergrande chicken to fail, they'll scare the other developers and they'll push more responsible behavior in the property sector. The risk is that they've picked the wrong chicken. Evergrande is so big, it's so indebted, that if they do allow a default by Evergrande, they might not be able to ring fence the contagion.
And that's what I want to ask you about, is the contagion. If investors see this and they start to say, well, wait a second, we're going to walk away from the entire Chinese property sector, that kind of thing, how could contagion happen?
So that's the concern, Scott. Firstly, there's the financial side. A pullback of investors from the Chinese property sector, from assets which are linked to the Chinese property sector, Australian iron ore mines, for example. If that happens, that has potential to really trigger a shift in global sentiment. The second avenue for contagion is in China's property sector itself. We're already seeing sales down. We're seeing construction down. If that slide continues, well, property is the single biggest driver of growth in the Chinese economy. Some estimates suggest that property accounts for about 30% of GDP. So if we see a Chinese property downturn deepening, that also means China's growth falls. That too sends ripples around the world.
Just very quickly, I do want to ask you about ripples around the world then. I mean, is this a company that, if it defaults or is seen as defaulting, could actually create markets crashing in New York, in London?
Evergrande itself is big, but the failure of a Chinese property developer in itself is not a global systemic event. What would send ripples around the world, if Evergrande fails and the Chinese government do not ring fence this effectively, if we get a slump in the Chinese property sector, if we get a sustained shift to risk-off sentiment in global markets, that's when the United States, that's when the Federal Reserve, that's when global markets have to start worrying.
All right, Tom Orlick, chief economist for Bloomberg Economics, and he's the author of China, the Bubble That Never Pops. Tom, thanks again for the time.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be here.
We are many, many months on from the Trump presidency, but books on Trump? Well, that four-year term is just beginning. The latest big title, Peril, came out this week, and it's from Bob Woodward, famous for breaking the Watergate scandal, and Robert Costa, his co-author at the Washington Post. What does it add to the Trump analysis and to the dozens of Trump books already out? Let's go to Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent and very busy reader. Ron, good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Scott.
And Ron, Peril is the third book in what we might call a Woodward trilogy here. There's Fear, there's Rage. How does Peril fit in?
It is the capper on the series, but it also extends the tension of the final days of Trump into the early months of the Biden presidency. And it makes clear that the disruptive effects of Trump's efforts to overturn the election that created the Biden presidency have not gone away and will continue. And in fact, as widely noted, the final two words of Peril are "Peril remains." Yet the bulk of the text is about 2020, the climax being the way Trump pressured state officials to overturn results in states he lost. Woodward and Costa really emphasize the pressure Trump put on Vice President Pence and how Pence struggled to decide what to do. And then, of course, Trump summons his supporters to Washington on January 6th and goads their march on the Capitol.
Now, it covers, the events of January 6th, but Peril also has a lot of reporting, as you mentioned a little bit, on the Biden presidency. What insights do Woodward and Costa provide there?
Yes, the January 6th reporting is really hour by hour, both up on the Hill and in the White House. But in the Biden case, he's really seen as being Trump's polar opposite in personality and in governing style. The authors introduce him by telling us that he decided to run for president against Trump after the Charlottesville marches and riot in August of 2017, because Biden says he wants to counter where Trump was taking the country. And so in his campaign and in his presidency so far, the contrast could scarcely be sharper. Where Trump was the towering and most compelling figure on the landscape, Biden's far more human scale, vulnerable, often seen as more importuning than commanding.
Now, there's a pile of Trump books out there, as you know, some by a much more controversial journalist, Michael Wolff. What do his books add to this picture?
Michael Wolff is a New York Magazine profile writer and biographer, as opposed to a Washington political journalist. But among the things he really can add are dramatic anecdotes about certain people that are not seen in the other books, people like Rupert Murdoch, the principal owner of News Corp and Fox News, Wall Street Journal. Wolff tells us that on election night, Trump tried to get Fox News to reverse its call of Arizona for Biden, and that this effort got all the way to Murdoch himself, who rebuffed it with an obscenity, according to Wolff.
Wow. So, I mean, there's that. There are the Washington journalists, and then there's this whole subgenre of books by Trump alumni who served in the White House. Some are glowing, some are blistering. What interests you there?
What's interesting is partly just the list. James Comey, the former FBI director that Trump fired, sure. Andrew McCabe, his successor, James Mattis, the first Secretary of Defense for Trump, H.R. McMaster and John Bolton, who were both the National Security Advisor through most of the Trump term, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador who also resigned. McMaster and Haley includes a lot of positive notes, admiring even of President Trump. But the rest of these works are far more blistering than glowing. And there are a number of others out there we don't have time to mention, and still more to come in the years to come.
Well, okay, so more books coming. Daily journalism, we often describe it as the first draft of history. Maybe these books are the second draft. But as you read them, what's still missing? What questions about the Trump presidency do you think are still out there to write about?
Well, one unresolved question is that of legal culpability. Did Trump break the law? Did he, in some sense or another, violate financial laws? Did his company break the law? That's not up to journalists or memoirists to decide. It's not even up to those insiders who may have witnessed it all. Trump was twice impeached, but twice acquitted by the Senate. So will he ever face a judge or a jury? We simply don't know. He will face the judgment of history, of course, but that too will take time.
And finally, let me make you choose here. What is the one book you'd suggest people read about the Trump presidency if they haven't read a single one?
I'm going to cop out a little bit and call it a draw between Peril, the Woodward Costa book we've been talking about, and another book called I Alone Can Fix It by two other Washington Post reporters, Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker. It covers much of the same 2020 ground and has a lengthy interview with Trump post-presidency at Mar-a-Lago. Woodward had lots of interview material in his second book, but none in the third because Trump said no. The Lenig and Rucker book serves as an excellent guide to what happened from the perspective of people present at the White House and on the campaign trail on a daily basis.
It's on my list. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Scott.
More Americans are dying from methamphetamines. New research shows overdose deaths tripled before the pandemic, but last year they spiked again, especially in some Black and Native American communities. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann reports.
This summer, Winnie Whitetail surveyed a new group of tribal members entering the inpatient treatment clinic she runs for the Arapaho and Cheyenne community in Clinton, Oklahoma. Whitetail, herself a Cheyenne tribal member, says half were struggling with methamphetamine addiction.
I believe it's deeply entrenched across the community, not just in Native communities. It's readily available. It's easy to get.
A new study published in the journal JAMA Psychiatry finds high-risk use of methamphetamines has surged in recent years. One of the study's lead authors is Dr. Nora Volkoff, who heads the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Volkoff says Native American and Alaska Native communities are being hit especially hard.
So this is a group that actually has had the greatest negative impact from the use of methamphetamine.
Volkoff's study found methamphetamine use has surged in nearly every demographic. Far more women are using methamphetamines. There has been a nearly tenfold increase among Black Americans. She says it now appears roughly one-fifth of drug overdose deaths in the U.S. involve methamphetamines.
And so this is huge, and it's basically almost equivalent in terms of the increase in overdose deaths that we're seeing for fentanyl and other synthetic opioids. So the magnitude of the problem is equivalent in terms of mortality.
Dr. Stephen Taylor has led an effort by the American Society of Addiction Medicine to improve addiction care for people of color. He says this study makes it clear America's public health response needs to expand fast beyond the opioid crisis, where he believes too much of the focus was on white communities.
the prototypical people who have been suffering from opioid addiction and dying from overdoses involving opioids have been white people in smaller towns and rural communities.
Taylor says even before this study was published, drug counselors and researchers working in urban areas and Black, Hispanic, and Native American communities knew methamphetamines were making dangerous inroads.
Those communities have been confronting a massive increase in addictions to and overdose deaths from methamphetamine for a long time.
The Biden administration has asked Congress for another $10.7 billion to expand drug treatment programs. But reducing the harm caused by methamphetamines won't be easy. The drug is cheap and widely available and increasingly contaminated with fentanyl. There are no approved medical treatments for methamphetamine addiction as there are for opioids. Researchers say this data shows more high-quality treatment and counseling services are desperately needed, especially programs that work within local cultures. Winnie Whitetail says that's what her programs do for the Arapaho and Cheyenne tribes, using community mentoring and traditional tribal practices, along with Western drug treatment approaches.
I think the younger we can reach our young people, we can begin to turn this corner. Because a lot of our issues are around low self-esteem, poverty, depression.
There is a final grim warning in this new study. Researchers say their assessment of the devastating harm caused by methamphetamines may not reflect the full scope of the crisis. That's because they weren't able to survey people living in homeless camps and on the streets around the U.S. where high-risk drug use is known to be widespread. Brian Mann, NPR News.
Germany will soon have a leader not named Angela Merkel for the first time in 16 years. Germans vote Sunday for a new parliament and government, and the longtime chancellor plans to step down when a new government is formed. Merkel has been a fixture in European politics, presiding over Germany with increasing influence on the continent and beyond. So, what legacy does she leave? Let's put that to Loveday Morris. She's Berlin bureau chief for the Washington Post, our editorial partners, and she's on Skype. Loveday, welcome.
Hi, thanks very much.
Yes, this is the end of a long political career for Angela Merkel. It's a checkered and debated legacy. We'll get into that debate. But first of all, what do observers consider as her top accomplishments as chancellor?
Well, yeah, I mean, Merkel's really been credited for being this steady hand at the rudder, really, for the past 16 years in Germany, overseeing kind of the revival of the German economy, and steering the country and Europe through three or four major crises that really have defined her career in some way. First, there was the European debt crisis. I mean, she was really the face of Northern European austerity in a way, and she very much held on to the purse strings in this period. Obviously, one of the more enduring images of Merkel will be her decision during the refugee crisis in 2015, and she opened Germany's doors to refugees at that time. And then there was also the coronavirus crisis. But with all of these things, her kind of record is kind of mixed. But yeah, I mean, those are kind of three crises that she's been seen as kind of steering Germany through. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the rise of far right groups on her watch. Is there a conversation about whether Angela Merkel, to some degree, has helped usher that in or allowed it?
You could definitely argue that some of her decisions have inadvertently given rise to the very kind of forces that she stands against, particularly the 2015 decision to let in more than a million refugees. That definitely drew a backlash. Germany's still grappling with that. You know, for the last couple of years, it's felt like you can't go a week without a scandal about right-wing chat groups in the police or right-wing threats linked to police computers. So those kind of problems, you know, the state has been accused of not looking hard enough at.
Now, this rise of these right-wing groups in Europe overlaps, of course, with the rise of Donald Trump here across the pond. And Angela Merkel decided reportedly decided, you know, I'm not going to step down right now, but I'm going to stick around because of the election of Donald Trump and kind of remain a force for liberalism in the West. Is there anything to that? And does that give us a little bit more of the picture of her here?
Sure. Yeah, that was reported in a book here by a German journalist. She certainly sort of spoken out against rising populism. She kind of hates being called things like the leader of the free world. She always kind of pushes back against those kind of titles. And she never really took Trump on head on, so to speak. I think she sees her role in a way as much more of a bridge between East and West, in a sense. I think her history and having grown up in a divided Germany, she's always talked about her fears of a new Cold War and keep talking to Russia and China and the US. And she's always trying to balance, I think, those geopolitical forces. I think that really comes from where she's come from and growing up behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War.
And so now, of course, Germany is getting ready to turn the page from this bridge-building internationalist, where kind of stable governance person Angela Merkel you're describing here. Going forward then, you know, what are the major challenges facing Germany that Angela Merkel's successor is going to have to contend with?
Sure. I think, I mean, the first challenge will probably be making a government at all. But yeah, there'll be with this challenge of where to position Germany internationally, and people will be looking towards Germany for leadership in Europe. There are all these questions of Europe needing to do more about its own security in a world where the US is kind of stepping back a little, and there'll still be the pandemic, obviously, and the economic fallout from that. So yeah, certainly there'll be a lot of challenges for her successor to deal with.
That is Loveday Morris. She's Berlin Bureau Chief for our editorial partners at the Washington Post. Loveday, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
Well, the pandemic was a bust for weddings and for wedding caterers, but this year business is back and booming and with a burst of imagination. Reporter John Kalish introduces us to caterers who cook on open fire in front of wedding guests.
Forget wedding catering done with stainless steel serving trays heated by propane burners. This is thousands of pounds of custom-made cast iron cookware, some of which has a definite steampunk style to it.
It takes a lot longer to master. It's kind of fun to deep fry in oil that you have absolutely no idea how hot it is.
That's sous chef Forrest Hansen, who cooks for a Vermont company called Hindquarter Catering. Some of that deep frying, by the way, is done in giant woks made from plow discs. Down in western Massachusetts, a catering company called Heirloom Fire has also mastered the art of cooking outdoors on an open wood fire.
That's what I love about the open fire, is that there is no preheat to 350. You know, you have to manipulate the fire. You're not really controlling the fire. You're almost dancing with it. If you're working with it, you want to befriend it. You can't master it. It's definitely your master.
That's James Gopp, Heirloom Fire chef and founder. His company boasts some decidedly retro cooking technology, including a clockwork spit roast, which can turn a 100-pound leg of beef. The contraption has a hand crank, a chain, and four cement balls hanging from an old mariner's hook. It works on the same principle as the pendulum in a grandfather clock. Crank it up and the beef will turn on the spit for 8 minutes.
It's a massive crowd pleaser. It's definitely the piece that gets the most attention. I'll show people and let them crank it up.
Back in Vermont, Hindquarter Catering deploys an outdoor oven called an Infernillo, used by the gauchos in Argentina. Hindquarter has been known to cook pork bellies with a thick soled crust in an Infernillo for hours and hours. Hindquarter's founder, Luke Stone, says he loves cooking outdoors and not being cooped up in a kitchen.
Most caterers are kind of hidden under a white tent somewhere, and nobody really knows where the food's coming from. We kind of just cook everything in front of you.
In addition to the vegetables, seafood, and pizza Hindquarter cooks, wedding guests eat up the spectacle of Hindquarter's outdoor cooking, says Jordan Von Trapp of the Bliss Ridge Wedding Venue in Moortown, Vermont.
It's a show, really, and they are totally fine with it. Some chefs, I think, would not be okay with having guests watch their every move. But these guys are totally laid back. And they explain things if people want to know.
Guests often ask where they can buy that custom cast iron cookware. Chef Luke Stone says they're also curious about another aspect of the operation.
Everybody wants to know what kind of wood we use.
We mostly use pressure treated and construction scraps.
Gardner Waldeyer is joking, of course. Waldeyer has commuted from Maine to Vermont for several years to cook for Hindquarter on weekends. He's found the work both exhausting and exhilarating.
I kind of equate it to a band on tour, and not only are we the band, but we're the roadies. Moving thousands of pounds of cast iron into a dual-axle trailer behind a one-ton dump truck that has a half a cord of split firewood. In the rain, in the dark.
Hindquarter staff is not always treated like rock stars, though. In fact, sometimes wedding guests are startled by the sight of an entire four-legged creature roasting over the fire. Again, sous chef Forrest Hansen.
People don't see the face of the animal that they are eating, or the whole body itself. They'll see a cut of the meat. So people walk by and see, you know, there's a snout and eyes on this pig that's spinning, and they get a little taken aback by it.
One of the challenges for open fire cooks is securing a reliable supply of local firewood, a burden necessitated by laws restricting the transport of firewood over state and even county lines. At Hindquarter Catering in Vermont, they go through 20 cords of wood each wedding season and split all of it themselves. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
All across the country, there are old mines and oil and gas wells. They might be hard to find, but they're also hard to manage. Many of them need expensive cleanup, and the companies that own them are often long gone or bankrupt. But Congress could soon send money to states to help fund these types of cleanups. Caitlin Kim of Colorado Public Radio reports.
Signs of the oil and natural gas industry are in almost every field I pass in Adams County, Colorado. But the oil site, known as Green Number 2, is different. It's a well that was orphaned in 2017 and is in the process of being cleaned up by the state. The pump jack was removed in July, but there are still a couple of empty tanks standing, one with a rusted door swung wide open. Greg Dean is the oil and gas liaison for Adams County.
When they removed the pump jack, they discovered historical leaks of produced water and oil into the soil and groundwater out in that field. So they're still doing sampling to see what the extent of that impact is, but this is a prime example of what an orphan site can do in Adams County.
An orphan well is one that has been abandoned by a company that no longer operates in the state. There are 77 orphan wells in Adams County alone. And when it comes to cleanup, it's the state left picking up the tab. That frustrates Adams County Commissioner Emma Pinter.
I feel like the analogy that keeps coming to mind is you go out to lunch with a couple of friends and, you know, you're going to have to pay the bill eventually. And as you look around, like two or three of your friends have slipped out the back and the rest of you are picking up the bill.
But another guest may soon join the table. The bipartisan infrastructure bill that Congress may pass next week contains more than $4.5 billion for plugging and remediating orphaned and abandoned oil and gas wells. But it may not be enough for the scope of the problem, says Greg Dean.
It could be upwards of 50 to 80 million just in Colorado. And that's if there aren't any extra wells added to the orphan well list.
Colorado has more than 250 orphan wells that need to be plugged. A 2019 study by the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission found 56,000 documented orphan wells across 30 states and estimates 19 times that number of undocumented orphan wells. And the bipartisan infrastructure bill doesn't just deal with the oil and gas legacy. It also contains billions for mine cleanup. Jason Willis with Trout Unlimited, a nonprofit working to preserve watersheds, is driving up a bumpy dirt road to his latest cleanup project. He's been working mine waste cleanup in southern Colorado for years and says infrastructure dollars could come in handy.
This is the fourth phase of cleanup, and I'm pulling funds from five to six different sources.
A grant from the Colorado Healthy Rivers Fund, private funding from local companies, including a mining company, and some U.S. Forest Service money, all to clean up mine waste, stop it from leaking into the watershed, and rehabilitate the surrounding landscape. And that's because there's no company left to take responsibility.
So then it's left to the taxpayers or the federal government or, you know, organizations like ours that go out and raise money to do these cleanups.
That's why the prospect of federal funds to really tackle coal and hard rock sites in the state excites Jeff Graves. He's program director for Colorado's Inactive Mine Reclamation Program.
I think it has a lot of potential to address a lot of these issues that we've really only been able to nibble at the edges on in some areas.
But this money, if it makes it into law, is not going to be a panacea. There are other steps, people argue, that need to be taken to make cleanups easier and prevent problems in the future. When it comes to oil and gas, Greg Dean from Adams County wants to see bonding reform. He says it's about ensuring companies are truly meeting the future cost to plug an abandoned well.
So in the past, a well would only require a $5,000 bond. So they would have to submit a $5,000 bond to the state to drill this well, where we know that the cost to plug and abandon this well is $85,000.
Forfeit the bond or pay to plug. You do the math. And when it comes to mines, Maya Mackamer would like to see Congress pass Good Samaritan laws to protect groups like hers from liability risks. Mackamer is director of the Boulder Watershed Collective. She grew up in the area playing in and around old mines. She sees the federal dollars in the infrastructure bill helping the area come full circle.
The history of mining is really compelling for a lot of the people who live around here. And so there's kind of this balance between that history and the damaging processes that came out of that time. But I feel like this is a great way of, like, kind of finishing the story. Mm. You know, that it all comes back around, and although it was causing issues in the watershed, now we're really looking at restoring that.
For both abandoned mines and orphan wells, there are long cleanup lists in the state. All involved hope the federal infusion of cash, if it comes, will help them go through the lists faster. For Here and Now, I'm Caitlin Kim.
And we're thrilled that you're listening to her and us on your local public radio station. But the conversation does not have to end here. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Here and Now. We're also on Instagram at Here and Now Radio. You can find me on Twitter at Here and Now Robin. Tanya is at Tanya Mosley.
And I'm at Tong Scott. And there's a whole team of producers, editors, engineers, directors that make this show what it is every day. You can learn more about them at hereandnow.org, and you have to meet them. Just click on Meet the Staff. It mm-hmm. is quite the staff. Mm-hmm. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. We'll be right back.